Good evening and welcome. It is a special pleasure to welcome a number of guests from area academic institutions and churches to our campus tonight. We're glad to have you here. This evening's event signals in a very significant way a renewed interest at this institution in providing scholarly resources for the St. Louis theological community. Concordia Seminary is going to be much more aggressive in the future in terms of offering and sharing with the larger community of St. Louis the various guests that we have on campus, various resources that we can provide, and we're so pleased to have such a number of guests off campus here this evening. I can think of no more auspicious beginning for that public lecture series than our guest tonight, Sir Henry Chadwick. Professor Chadwick is known to the students of Concordia Seminary, and I suspect to the students of a number of other theological institutions represented here this evening, particularly through his book, The Early Church, Volume 1 in the Pelican History of the Church. However, his writings, scholarship, and interests cover a wide variety of areas. He is recognized certainly as one of the most foremost historians of the early church, but is a master of many other fields as well. A leading evangelical theologian once remarked in my presence, "Henry Chadwick knows just about everything." Sir Henry Chadwick was educated at Eton and Magdalen College of Cambridge University. He has been a fellow of colleges in Oxford as well as Cambridge. He has served as Regius Professor of Divinity at both Oxford and Cambridge. He has presented the most prestigious lectures of Britain, the Gifford Lecture at St. Andrews, the Birkbeck Lectures at Cambridge, and the Sarum Lectures at Oxford. He has been honored with doctorates from Yale, the University of Chicago, the University of Glasgow, the University of Manchester, Leeds, and other institutions. The bibliography that was published in his Festschrift in 1988 listed over 175 published works. He was editor of the Journal of Theological Studies for 30 years, from 1954 to 1985. Henry Chadwick has also been an active participant in major ecumenical ventures, including the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commissions 1 and 2, the Faith and Order Advisory Group, and the Anglican Orthodox Commission. In 1989, he was knighted commander of the British Empire. Sir Henry Chadwick is presently Master of Peterhouse, the oldest college of the University of Cambridge. Tonight, he will address the topic on rereading the Confessions of St. Augustine. It is an honor and a privilege to welcome Sir Henry Chadwick and his wife to the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis.
Dr. Johnson, ladies and gentlemen, and very kind friends, you will be right if you judge that it is to me a very great delight and honor to be in this seminary, surely one of the most beautiful of all seminary campuses in the Western world, and an institution which has a very justified reputation for the seriousness of studies in this place. I thought that you might like to reflect about Augustine's Confessions for this reason, that it is just 1600 years ago this year that the young man who was born in what are now the hills of eastern Algeria on a small farm and had an extraordinary career as a teacher of Latin literature and oratory, was then converted to Orthodox Christianity, was baptized at Milan by St. Ambrose, returned to North Africa, and 1600 years ago, in the year 391, was forcibly ordained to be a presbyter. It was a very unwelcome event in his life. His ordination reduced him to floods of tears. I hesitate to mention that in a seminary. But it was no doubt a realistic assessment of what was to come. He had wanted, after his conversion in July 386 at Milan, he'd wanted to live a withdrawn, contemplative life in a quasi-monastic community of congenial male friends, one of whom was fortunately sufficiently rich to finance it all. And then, one day, one weekend, he was up at the coast, 45 miles from his home, it's Tagaste, in the hills, and he visited the port of Hippo Regius, today the port of Annaba. The French called the place Bone. And he went to church on Sunday morning. The bishop was preaching. The bishop was a Greek speaker from southern Italy, where his family had some land. And the population of a port like Hippo would be partly Latin-speaking and partly Greek. The Bishop Valerius was not very competent in Latin, and he wanted a presbyter who could preach to the people in language which would please them and not be painful on their ears. He spotted the young Augustine in his congregation, and he preached a sermon to tell the congregation that he had for many years wanted a presbyter to assist him, who was good in Latin, and by a most singular providence, on that Sunday morning, there was a unique opportunity for the congregation to make their feelings known and express their will. And they realized what was required of them, and they forced him there and then to accept ordination to the presbyterate despite his tears. Many in the ancient world, and especially in North Africa, found their way to ordination by force. In our Western world, especially under the influence of evangelicalism, perhaps, we expect candidates for orders to have had their heart strangely warmed. The ancient church thought that the call came through the church, and I have myself been present at an ordination in the Patriarchal Cathedral, Bucharest, where a fine-looking young man was brought forward to be ordained by the patriarch by the two largest all-in wrestlers I have ever seen. Any idea that the young man had a serious choice in the matter was quite unreal, and he lay on the floor prostrate, quivering with fear, but it was perfectly clear it would have been quite unacceptable to the society and to the church if he had not accepted. Something of that is the spirit of Augustine becoming an ordained minister of the church. And yet, what an effect it had. His conversion in 386, yes, was a watershed in his life, and in the 8th book of the Confessions, it is wonderfully told how that came about. How, under a sense of enormous constraint, he finally made the act of will. It took him a long time. In one of his later writings, he described conversion as taking about as long as pregnancy. It was a painful business. And at the time, in the Confessions, he describes it as like a man warm in bed, deferring getting up on a cold morning. He put it off, and he put it off, and he put it off. And finally he says, I realized that I had only one barrier, and that was simply an act of will. There was no other obstacle, simply to make a decision. He regretted ordination. He didn't want to be ordained one little bit. He wanted to be contemplative, meditative, a monk. And yet, it transformed his life. And the change wrought by ordination can be seen to be greater, even greater, than the change wrought at his conversion in 386. Not so very much had changed, really. He still went on writing books about literature, rhetoric, grammar. He wrote a Latin grammar. He tells us later that it had been stolen from his library and he hadn't got a copy. But a young woman working in Cambridge found it 3 years ago, and it's now available to us. It survived. It wasn't survived to him, but it survived by another route. So the stolen copy was copied and has come down to us. He was writing, in other words, books of elementary education for people wanting to get started, and he went on doing that. But ordination, the first thing he did to Bishop Valerius on having been ordained was to ask for a sabbatical so that he could go off. I need to study the Bible, he said. I don't know very much about it. I must go and read the Bible. In fact, all the works for which Augustine of Hippo is world famous were all written after his ordination. Indeed, after he became a frenetically busy diocesan bishop with endless troubles every day. For he became a presbyter and a bishop at a harshly controversial time and place. He was serving what was then a minority congregation in a city where the majority were schismatics of the Donatist persuasion, and they were a tough lot to deal with. The fact that ordination produced such very good books from his pen is significant of the fact that the optimum degree of stress for human beings is very seldom zero. Very seldom. There are moments when perhaps you're wondering whether somebody you know would be up to taking a very strenuous post, and you know they've had rather a bad track record of ill health. I have a friend to whom just that happened. They gave him an enormously strenuous job, and he never had a day's illness afterwards. Well, with Augustine, something of the same kind of thing occurred. For ordination committed him. It screwed him down in a way that he'd never been screwed down before. It committed him to learning to understand the faith he was now professing, much of which he'd only really dimly apprehended. There was much that he only really came to understand after he'd become a bishop. And, of course, he changed his mind on many things at many times in his life. He once, in fact, more than once, wrote, "I am one of those who clears his mind by writing and makes progress as I write. And as I progress, I write." Ordination identified him with the visible community of the church. And he realized that the church was not just quite like his little community of congenial friends. It had very awkward members, some characters who were distinctly difficult. He once wrote, "The church is like Noah's Ark, a small group of rational and spiritual persons are from time to time distressed by the malodorous company they have to keep, but they know it is preferable to certain death in the tempest outside." Moreover, ordination concentrated his mind on particular problems, concrete situations which required the application of thought. He was no longer a free spirit, roaming as he wished, where he felt inclined. He was now addressing painful, social, personal problems. All his books emerged because something or somebody was digging him in the ribs, so to speak. He wasn't just sitting down with pen and paper saying, "What shall I write about next?" Somebody was asking awkward questions. Somebody was being difficult. Somebody had to have a book addressed to him. Moreover, he was now a man under authority. He was, to use the phrase he applied to his own mother Monica, servant of the servants of God, a phrase which came to have a memorable history in the papal chancery, all papal letters from the 7th century onwards describe the popes as servus servorum Dei, servant of the servants of God. But the first time the phrase was used is in the Confessions of Ave Monica. Ordination meant he could no longer retire for quiet reflection, for a kind of mixture of Platonic and Christian contemplation, elevating the soul to God in a flight of the alone to the alone. The Confessions do not record his ordination. The autobiographical parts of the book, the first 9 books, tell us of his youth, his career, the various influences on him, how he'd had a series of perfectly appalling teachers who knew nothing, a series of really dismal teachers whom he utterly scorned and despised. I don't know if the autobiography of Sir Osbert Sitwell ever found its way across the Atlantic to this country, but in the reference book Who's Who, Sir Osbert Sitwell always described himself as educated in the holidays from Eton. Something of the same happened to Augustine. He didn't learn much at school, but the school did bring him to Virgil and to Cicero, and he knew Virgil by heart and many of the works of Cicero. So much so that little phrases, two words here and there, three words in another context, are simply worked into his prose as entirely unmarked quotations. I discovered one from Virgil myself only a little time ago, and I am quite sure that there is quite a lot more to be found in the way of these unmarked quotations from Latin classics. It was just part of his mind. The autobiographical books of the Confessions end in Book 9 with the intensely moving account of his mother's death. The memorable passage where his dying mother looks up at him and she thanked me that she could not remember any occasion when I had said a harsh word to her. And you can feel the lump in the throat as the sentence was written. Wonderful account of Monica's death and burial, told with great restraint and economy and passionate feeling. He owed her a very great deal. And then in books 10, 11, 12, and 13, you have a quite different kind of book. Discussions of memory, easily the most intelligent discussion of memory that anybody in the ancient world was going to write. A discussion of time and eternity, the famous phrase, "I know just what time is, as long as nobody asks me." And then a discussion of what was meant by creation. Genesis 1, what is the concept of creation? Is it sensible to say, what was God doing before the creation of the world? And then Augustine gives the famous reply, please don't give the silly answer, making hell hotter for curious questioners. Because the answer betrays that you have accepted the presuppositions of the questioner. And what you should have said is that it's a very silly question to ask. Then you can get started. The idea that there could be time before creation is nonsensical, says Augustine. Creation and time are the same thing. And then the final tour de force in the last book, the 13th book, so difficult and rebarbative to the modern reader, where you suddenly discover that the first chapter of the book of Genesis is actually an amazingly elaborate allegory about the church and the means of grace. And that, I'm sure, had never occurred to you before. And Augustine is going to show just what he can do when he really tries. The Confessions don't record the ordination. But they were written after he'd become a bishop. And it is cardinal to understanding that very complicated and fascinating work, one of the greatest works in Christian prose. It is cardinal to understanding it to realize that the book was written by the Bishop of Hippo. It was not written by somebody recording at the time. He is telling his story from a particular point of view. Yes, it tells his life, how a young man of 17 was a student, bookish, quiet, highly sexed. He took to his bed a low-class but Catholic girlfriend at Carthage. He nevertheless very soon joined the Theosophical sect of Manichaeans, for whom procreation was a forbidden act and sexual intercourse was a diabolical invention. So it was an unusual sect for such a man to join, but he did. He goes on to tell how he gradually lost confidence in the Manichae mythology, which was pretty unbelievable and extravagant, passed into total skepticism about everything, and then became drawn, as he got to Milan, into a circle who greatly admired the late Platonists, especially Plotinus of the 3rd century and his editor and biographer and commentator, Porphyry. At Milan, he tells us, he used to go to hear Ambrose preach in the cathedral, not because he wanted to take part in the Christian act of worship, but because he was himself a professor of oratory, and Ambrose was the best orator in town, and he wanted to admire the bishop's oratorical skill. And as he listened, he said, it's not only very good language, beautiful sentences, lovely periods, lovely flowing rhythmic Latin prose, that was what he'd come to admire. He suddenly realized that this was very intelligent, devout man. North Africa was rather short of bishops like that. I hope it's not offensive to anybody here if I say that it might be described as the Bible Belt of the ancient church. On the whole, people were frightened of thinking too hard in the North African church. Augustine found himself riveted by the preacher's content as well as his style. And then he found himself gripped at the solar plexus by the extraordinary beauty of the psalm chants. Augustine was very vulnerable to music. The most interesting and important utterance any Christian, I believe, has written on the subject of church music is to be found in the 10th book of the Confessions of St. Augustine. That is where he says, I love the music, but I have come to feel guilty if the music matters to me more than the words. You see how at once he goes to the heart of the matter. Well, at Milan, he was converted. He returned to the faith and practice of his mother, Monica, and at Milan he made the surprising discovery that the Orthodox Catholic Church had monasteries, had lay monastic communities. There was one in the suburbs of Milan, just outside the city wall. Humble, simple people. And that moved him much. And as he heard of them, he said to his friend Alypius, what are we doing with our high culture which has no heart or feeling to it, while these simple and uneducated people are storming the kingdom of heaven? And so, in the garden at Milan, in a flood of tears, he made his decision. He tells us in exquisite prose, and Augustine could write wonderful Latin prose when he set out to try, he tells us how he heard a voice, as it were, was it of a boy or of a girl, playing the other side of the garden wall and saying, pick up, read, tully, leggy. Was it a phrase in some child's game? I didn't know. But I went to the table under the fig tree and opened the Codex of St. Paul at random and found the text of Romans 13, and serenity flooded into my heart. Even if it's more poetry than prose, or more literary than precise historical record, we don't really know. It's so wonderfully written that, at least in France, there are very few people who think it happened just like that. Nevertheless, it is certain that the point of the story is the randomness of it at two points. Not only the randomness of the Bible text, but the fact that the child on the other side of the wall had nothing further from its blissful mind than the edification of Augustine. And that's the crux of the story. It was, you might say, pure chance. Or was it pure chance? Augustine was no great believer in chance. I'll return to that in a moment. It was, after all, an unforeseen and very unintended matter that he went to church service on Sunday morning at Hippo and came out a presbyter. That was not at all what he had started out to do when he got out of bed that morning. What happened to him when he was a presbyter? He became a dispenser of the word and sacraments. Bishop Valerius departed from universal custom of the North African churches by allowing the presbyter, Augustine, to preach in his presence. That was not at all in accordance with North African custom. And that was why he needed to study the Bible. And his works from ordination onwards show a somber and serious engagement, especially with the Pauline letters in the first instance, and always with the book of Genesis, because the book of Genesis, especially Genesis 1, 2, and 3, was deeply offensive to the Manichees to whom he had once belonged. And the Confessions contain many passages of sustained attack on Manichee belief and practice. At Hippo, as a presbyter, and then 5 years later, 6 years later perhaps, as a bishop, he found that he was not only performing a ministerial function of word and sacrament, though that was the cardinal thing. He also had much social responsibility, helping widows, orphans, foundlings, those whose names were on the church list for receiving financial support and meals on wheels. In his preaching, the duty of almsgiving is a very frequent theme. There was one sermon, a midwinter sermon, when it was pretty cold, and he suddenly tells the congregation, "The beggars at the church porch are telling me that you were very ungenerous to them this morning. It's very cold. Please, would you put your hands in your purses and do something for them?" One learns a very great deal in Augustine from Augustine's sermons and letters, but especially the sermons about the situation of the poor. The experience taught him, and he says it in The City of God, Book 5, that the problem of destitution has become too great to be solved by private charity. It can be met only by state action and some redistributive taxation, which, he adds, I am sure the rich would be happy to pay. for thereby they would of course avert a dangerously alienated underclass which was easily capable of staging a very ugly riot if they were hungry and dispossessed of all land. St. Jerome, in his commentary on the Minor Prophets, those of you who comfortably read Latin and want to know what horrors were going on in the 4th century church should go and read St. Jerome on the Minor Prophets. Electrifying reading, I can assure you. Gripping stuff. Jerome was the man who thought that the church was not merely the inheritor of the church built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets. It was also the inheritor of the apostasy of the people of God in the Old Testament, where almost everything was going wrong, and you get the impression that half the clergy were alcoholics. I feel sure that Jerome was given to exaggeration here as elsewhere, but it is a very formidable and somber picture that he had to paint. And at one point he does say that riots in cities have become very common, and the major cause of them is high interest rates. I thought you might like to know that. The fostering of works of mercy was an important part of the vocation of clergy. But there were also a more secular aspect to the presbyter and the bishop's calling. Especially as a bishop, he found he was expected to write recommendations to get jobs for members of his congregation. And he found it distasteful, but it was the accepted system and had to be done. His biographer tells us how he liked to quote a wise man saying, "I have too much regard for my own reputation to vouch for that of my friends." But the worst part of the bishop's task, which he found endlessly irritating, was arbitrating between quarrelling members of his flock. A legacy of course, the apostles' exhortation in 1 Corinthians that the people of God must not take their disputes to the magistrate's court, for the magistrate's authority counts for nothing in the church. God, cries Augustine in the Confessions, is the very life of the poor. He himself lived like one of the poor. We have an account of what food was like at his table. Very modest food indeed. A poor man's meal. The one thing you were always sure of was there was going to be some wine to make the point that he was not a Manichee. Otherwise, it was a very simple meal. He was a poor man living among the poor. He was, of course, expected to protect his people. He had problems with delinquents. He had a great problem, a recently discovered letter of Augustine, discovered in the National Library in Paris just a few years ago, discovered by a Viennese scholar to the intense irritation of the French professors. It was discovered in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. And this letter tells us that Augustine is consulting a distinguished lawyer of the time. He wants to know the position, because quite a well-to-do farmer has sold his wife to a slave trader. And I expostulated with him, says Augustine, but he then replied, "I'd much rather have the money." And Augustine consulted the lawyer about what should be done about this. You see the kind of problem that beset a bishop. He found himself unpopular with his congregation if he didn't accept a big legacy for the church, because he would not accept a legacy if it left the children without sufficient means of support. And so in his church at Hippo, he often found himself surrounded by very severe critics. Once he was bequeathed, the church, that's to say, was bequeathed, a considerable estate, and attached to that estate was the responsibility to provide a ship for taking the grain supply from Hippo to Italy, to Rome, to feed the population. That was an enormously lucrative thing to be given. But there was a catch in it. If the ship was shipwrecked, the church had a total obligation by law to replace the ship, the value of its cargo, and there would be a judicial inquiry into the causes of the loss, at which surviving members of the crew would be vulnerable to being tortured. No bishop could accept such a legacy, says Augustine. And his congregation said, but it's worth an enormous sum of money to us. It would give us much more people to be able. We could feed far more people if we have it. We're not going to have anybody tortured around here, was Augustine's reply, and we're not going to accept that estate. He was wildly unpopular with his people for saying that. There is one place where he says, among critics of bishops, no critic is quite so ferocious as a prominent layman who is upset by a liturgical change. There were political problems for him. He was expected to intercede for his people when they got into trouble with the taxman or the magistrates. Some little act of delinquency, he would be expected to intervene with the magistrate and say, please treat him very mercifully or let him off, or it's a first offense, or his family is really awfully nice. The kind of thing, I'm afraid, that clergy are even today expected from time to time to supply. When the delinquency was fairly serious, then episcopal interventions merely irritated the civil authorities. And the civil authorities did not welcome interventions by Augustine or any other bishop. One sermon gives an absolutely vivid portrait of how he had gone on behalf of his congregations, to call on the deputy governor at Hippo, and had been kept waiting 2 or 3 hours for an interview while persons both just and unjust were admitted before me. And finally he got through the veil to the chamber of the deputy governor and was treated with an arctic coldness. And it was no fun whatever. And so he wrote the sentence, no one who has not been ordained and had to do this sort of thing would ever believe what people expect us to do. There was a social side for the ministerial task which he accepted, but it was too secular and he resented it. Now, in the last book of the Confessions, there are sentences that echo those situations. When you get beyond the biographical, autobiographical books to book 10, suddenly you meet the sentence, in this book I am confessing to you, my God, who I now am, not what I once was. I am confessing how you brought me to be a preacher of your word and to dispense your sacrament. So, the confessions are selecting those incidents in his early career which will show you how he came to be where he was. And now we come to what may be to some of you a little surprise. We look back in retrospect on Augustine, we say, what a very great man. How extraordinary that the North African church, the hills of eastern Algeria as they are now, what was then ancient Numidia, should have produced the most intelligent man of his century, as he certainly was, and that he became bishop of a little port on the North African coast and stayed there for the rest of his life. He was 39 years a clergyman at Hippo. It's a long time. What are the confessions telling us about that? I've mentioned that he had detractors. Some of the critics were very vocal indeed. And they were vocal at the time when he was being put forward to be coadjutor bishop. Valerius of Hippo wanted to prevent any other church carrying off his eloquent presbyter who preached such spellbinding sermons. And so he asked the elderly primate in the North African provinces. The primate was the senior bishop by date of consecration. That had the consequence that the primate was almost always so elderly as to be virtually gaga, and there were disadvantages about the system. You see how it wouldn't work always very well. Well, there was a very elderly primate down the road at Kalama, which is not very far from Hippo. It was the adjacent diocese. And he was asked to consecrate Augustine as coadjutor bishop, and he wrote to Valerius expressing deep consternation. For the African churches, only too well remembered this man as a combative Manichee who'd humiliated illiterate or half-educated bishops with difficulties about the Old Testament. And then he'd gone around founding monastic communities. Were they Manichee cells in disguise, people asked. The ascetic movement of the 4th century was not at all welcome in every place. There was a considerable body of opposition to it. Congregations which didn't want unmarried clergy, people who suspected the monks of being Manichees. And then Augustine hadn't been baptized in North Africa. He claimed to have been baptized in Northern Italy at Milan. Was it by Ambrose? Well, was there a certificate of that? It was customary in Africa, if a man was baptized in a city other than his hometown, for the baptizing bishop to write a letter and say, could you please send me a recommendation of good character and conduct for this candidate for baptism? Had Ambrose written to Carthage, to Hippo, to Tagaste, to Africa, anywhere? So in the Confessions, there is a very, very low-key, laconic, brief account of how he and his natural son and his friend Alypius were baptized at Milan in Easter 387. Those of you who have been to Milan will have seen the actual font where this occurred, which has been excavated by the archaeologists. The whole story, in other words, is looking over his left shoulder, which I should say with the president sitting on my left, his right shoulder, for fear of somebody with a sandbag being about to hit him. Who would hit him? Those who were afraid he was still a Manichee. But then there were also those who didn't like him for being so clever. North Africans just weren't used to having somebody of that degree of intelligence about preaching to them. Sitting on the episcopal bench, it seemed very odd. And he could write such wonderful Latin prose. They were suspicious of that. Some Christians, he writes in the Confessions, are on their guard if polished and high style is employed to present the truth. Insofar as a fine style doesn't make anything true, they are quite right. But if this skill is deployed in support of the truth, isn't that all right? He was, of course, always a teacher. He once defines the church as a comprehensive school of both sexes, all ages, and all social classes and income brackets. And in that school, it's the less intelligent who need eloquence. They not only need to be taught, they need to be persuaded. In this church, rich and poor, noble and low-born, they're all equal. On no account may those at the bottom of the heap be treated with any inhumanity. And then in the Confessions he will tell you that in mind and intellectual power, men and women are entirely equal, even though the woman's biological destiny is determined and gives her a domestic and less public role. Perhaps I might insert into in parenthesis that Augustine says nothing severe about the feminine sex, that it's incomprehensible to me that the feminist movement has cast him in a rogue's as a rogue in their story. It's not true, and he's much more beastly to the male sex than he is to the female. But that's a different lecture. He insists in the Confessions that in the church spiritual judgment is exercised no less by laity than by clergy. The perception of the will of God is not only granted to the ordained, but to all spiritual members. He knows that in the church, the word priest, sacerdos, is applied to the bishop and presbyter. But it's not quite correct, he says, because all Christians share in the one priest who is Christ. Those of you who are Protestants may think that's good stuff. I should therefore like to balance it and undo all the good that remark has done by telling you that he had just as many reservations about the title pastor for all the same reasons. Neither priest nor pastor are used of human ministers in other than an inaccurate sense. There is only one priest for the church. There is only one pastor. The minister is purely ministerial to the priesthood and the shepherding of the Lord. And he hates Donatist language about a bishop in apostolic succession being an exclusive mediator to God, or about, I quote a Donatist document, holy clergy obtain for unworthy laity gifts they could never obtain for themselves. And Augustine just erupts in anger at such clerical ideas of the church. There were other critics too. Augustine had once been a very gifted teacher of literature and rhetoric. And pagan teachers of rhetoric could not forgive him having given it up. They thought that very, very wrong of him. And it is a remarkable fact that the Confessions is in fact the most elaborate piece of rhetoric that he ever wrote. that it's got a great number of classical quotations, far more than anything else that he wrote, from Virgil, Cicero, Terence, other writers too. Sallust, he loved Sallust. The famous remark of Sallust that Roman society consisted of private affluence and public squalor, that seemed to Augustine magnificent prose. I just thought I'd tell you it was Sallust, because now it's always attributed to J.K. Galbraith. But it is, in fact, verbatim from the ancient Roman historian. Augustine loved Sallust for his pictures of that. Well, he had offended former secular colleagues. They hated his Bible study. And so you get, in Book 11 of the Confessions, this sentence addressing God. You are not irritated by the burning zeal with which I study your scripture. Deduction, there were people who were irritated. Some human contemporaries found it very trying. Some of them may have been Catholic exegetes who thought that he'd shown the door to the Manichaeans only to invite the Platonists into the vacant space. But there are also, I think, pagan, educated, literary figures. And therefore, the Confessions isn't just a catalogue of past misdemeanors. When you're reading the Confessions, you are also reading a work of subtle and sometimes ironic self-defense. It's a work also of self-vindication. I must conclude. The young professor, aged 32, was converted under a sense of great constraint. He was ordained under great constraint. His great books, the Confessions, the City of God, the Trinity, and the others, were all written in a desperately busy pastoral ministry under the pressure of events and people. And as he wrote these books, he was aware he was writing for us in the future. One letter expressly says, I am writing for the future. He knew that he was making the West his heirs. So let me simply conclude by saying that if you think human beings are rather frail in will, commonly very ill-informed on all the relevant facts, inclined to be self-interested in their decisions and moral judgments, if you are of the opinion that your feelings are pretty dangerous things to have around, but they are positive and the dynamo that drives you forwards, if you think religious faith has its springs in a kind of surrender to the invasive power of divine grace, if you think that there are things that you know that you don't know you know because they're at unconscious levels of your mind, I could enormously extend the catalogue of ifs, but that will do for tonight. If you have said, yes, I think those are all true, then all of you who think that those are true are devoted disciples of St. Augustine of Hippo, your Augustinians, men and women alike. Thank you very much.
Professor Chadwick has kindly indicated that he would be happy to respond to questions about the life and influence of St. Augustine for a few moments, or in the light of the quotation that I included in the introduction of him, I suspect you could ask anything else you wanted to know as well. Are there any questions to be addressed to Professor Chadwick? Pastor Kurowski.
Sure. I really appreciate your lively translation of the Confessions. I keep it close to the second most favorite book of mine, next to Holy Scripture, C.F.W. Walther's Proper Distinction Between Law and Gospel. And it's a very, very wonderful translation. Thank you.
Thank you. Where's going?
The question that I have comes from the context of one of our great Lutheran confessional ecumenists by the name of Hermann Sasse.
Mm-hmm.
Sasse would foment over the fact that Augustine was not given his biological due. He believed that it should be noted not only that he was from Africa, and though Latin in mentality, that he was black. Why this is very important and a relevant question, I would like to state for three reasons. I work in an urban area where many of our black Christians in our church are harassed by black Muslims. The assertion of the black Muslims, which I believe is out of step with history, is that Christianity is a white man's religion, and consequently, they don't see the contributions that come from all four corners of the world. It's also a very important question with regard to the whole debate on the liturgy today. Many people, for instance, even within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, believe that our liturgy is solely a German product, a European product, and again, don't see it going back not hundreds of years, but thousands of years, with contributions, again, from all four corners. And if anyone reads Augustine, he had a tremendous sense of liturgy, and you touched on that in your presentation. Thirdly, there is a lively debate going on. For instance, there was a program that was conducted on PBS where William Buckley was the host, and there was one chap on that particular program who said, well, of course, everybody knows the myth that Augustine was black, and of course, it's not true, he went on, but he offered no evidence for that. Could you be so kind to clear up some of those matters there that we might be able to have a correct perspective on that? Thank you.
Thank you for your question, Pastor. Exactly what color his skin was, I'm sorry to tell you, we don't really know. The earliest portrayal of him we have was done about 100 years, surviving portrayal was done about 100 years afterwards. We've got a contemporary portrait of Ambrose, which you can go and see in mosaic at Milan, but then he was high brass. He was a senator. He had more than a touch of class, as they say. Augustine did not. He was a poor man from the hills of Algeria. He was a striking instance of what degree of social mobility could still take place in the later Roman Empire. Now, his mother's name was Monica, and Mon was a Berber deity. It's very likely indeed that Monica was Berber. And Augustine expressly tells us that she spoke Latin with a highly demotic syntax. She wasn't very good at it. She could make her meaning clear, but it was full of, as it were, vulgar errors. We don't know what ethnic origin his father was. His father's name was Patricius. And he was a pagan who was baptized on his deathbed. And the likelihood is that both parents are of Berber origin. In other words, they were part of the native population of the North African plain between the mountains and the sea, the Sahara and the sea. And that is, the likelihood is that they were, shall I say, dark brown. Having said that, I ought to add, in fairness, that, of course, the peasants on the farms were Punic-speaking, the legacy of the old Phoenician occupation of that part of the world, and they still spoke Punic. And Augustine knew some of the Punic language. He once tells his Latin-speaking congregation that the word mammon, yes, some of you hear the peasants speaking Punic in the field saying mamona. It's the same for Phoenician, is related to Hebrew, he says, and it means money. And he helps them to understand it in this way, so that mammon is interpreted by the Punic words. Augustine knew some Punic, not very, very much, but some. Having said that, one must add that his culture was entirely Latin at school, and that Latin was the language spoken in the house at home. Monica and he conversed in Latin. They didn't converse in Punic. That is has some bearing on it. You've got to distinguish between ethnicity and culture at this point. The culture of Augustine and his family is 100% Latin culture. But then, having said that, one must also, I'm sorry there's such a long answer to a short question, but one must remember that before the 7th century of our era, before the Islamic conquest, the North African plain and what is north of the Mediterranean are a single economy and one political society. It is only religion that has divided the two sides of the Mediterranean since the Islamic conquest. In fact, in economic terms, inevitably, they belong together all the time. You can't go to Algeria even today without knowing that while they don't terribly love the French, or most of them don't terribly love the French, they are in fact wholly dependent on metropolitan France for the viability of their economy. The two sides are intimately linked. It was much more so in antiquity. For example, the part, the province of the Roman Empire in which Tangier now stands was governed by one administration with the southern part of Spain. The Straits of Gibraltar were in the middle of a Roman province. They didn't separate two provinces. That tells you how closely they felt the north and south sides to be linked. So what you haven't got in Augustine and in Augustine society is a sense that we Africans are quite different over against the Europeans. But he was very proud of being an African. He could forgive even Apuleius for writing soft pornography on the ground that he was an African. That says a good deal, doesn't it? Afa. The Golden Ass, the Metamorphoses, start by telling you I am setting out to write a Milesian tale. That is the ancient Latin for soft porn. The book was essentially written for that market. And Augustine, yes, he realized that it was very well written, marvelous Latin, very powerful stuff to read, and he was one of us. He belonged to our African culture. There's one place where he was delighted to discover Africa mentioned in the Bible, in the Old Testament, as though Africa was part of it. And, of course, Simon of Cyrene was a great hero for the African churches. They wanted to know that they had had a part in the gospel story. So there was an African regional patriotism, but color counted for almost nothing in ancient society. It was utterly different. It wasn't a social barrier at all to be less than white or more than black. I hope that's an honest answer to your question. It took me a little time to get round it, but I think that is a correct historical answer to the question I have been asked.
Sir, another question to Professor Chadwick. You need not feel compelled to use the microphone up here. Professor Feuerhahn.
Professor Chadwick, if you'll indulge an announcement rather than a question. This week, a catalog came from Oxford University Press informing us that there is a new translation of the Confessions available soon by Henry Chadwick with notes and introductions. I'm sure the audience will look forward to this coming into the bookstore soon.
You are very kind, Professor Feuerhahn. The book is available in hardback now at what I thought was a rather high price, but it's being paperbacked in February at a most modest sum and will cease to pay for my summer holiday thereafter.
Is there another question? If not, I should again like to thank you for being on the campus of Concordia Seminary, especially our guests from other institutions and churches. And I would invite you back to be with us October 17th at 7:30, at which time the seminary will be sponsoring a lecture by another Cambridge Don, noted Reformation scholar Peter Brooks. October 17, 7:30, Professor Brooks will be speaking on the topic, Henry VIII, Defender of the Faith. Henry VIII, Defender of the Faith. I hope there's a punctuation with a question mark after that. Again, thank you for being here this evening. It's been a delight to have Professor Chadwick. Thank you.
Thank you so much.